Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Welcome to the show today. I am very excited to introduce this guest that I just happened to see last week on, was it Meet the Farmer?
Or Growing Yes, it was. Meet the Farmer.
Meet the Farmer. And already I contacted him right away while he was still on the show. And he emailed me back. And here he is today from New Jersey Bees. Welcome, Daniel Center. Is it Daniel or Danny?
It's Danny. It's Daniel. It's Dan. It's whatever anybody calls me.
Okay. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm telling you, listeners, I learned so much in like the first 2 minutes of watching that show. I was on his website in no time, and I just know you're going to love this. So go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I began beekeeping about 5 years ago. I was visiting a friend of mine's farm. He needed some help with his mobile chickens. And I looked across the field, and there was this chain link fence with a bunch of boxes in it. And I asked him, what's that? And he said, oh, those are my bees. I'm like, oh, wow, cool. You have bees. What's the chain link fence for? That's not going to keep the bees in or out. He goes, oh, that's to keep the bears out. And I'm like, bears, bees, I'm sold. And I started reading up on things. And about 6 months later, I purchased my first package of bees. And since then, it's grown. I do a whole bunch of bee rescue. I sell a whole bunch of honey. I've got about 20 hives that I manage right now. It's a hobby sort of gone wild.
Okay. So I do always kind of like to start the show out asking my guests to tell us about their very first gardening experience. Like, how old were you? Were you a kid? Who were you with? Were you an adult? What'd you grow? Like, just give us a little background there.
Okay, so I can't claim to be, although I have a really nice garden on my property in upstate New York, I can't claim to be an expert gardener. When I was a very young child, my grandparents lived next door to a guy who tilled his backyard and made it into a wonderful garden. And that was one of my first experiences. I was probably maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old. And I'd wander into the back of his backyard. He'd take me back there. He'd show me the carrots, the tomatoes, the various other things that he grew. And over the years, I'm very into the outdoors. So I've been around gardeners and I've been around gardening and done a lot of work tangentially related to. So, but I'd certainly say my earliest experiences were with Mr. Ribner in North Bergen, New Jersey.
Excellent. Now, you're in New York, but isn't your thing called New Jersey Bee?
That's an excellent question. I'm born and bred in New Jersey. My home, my primary home, is in Teaneck, New Jersey, and I do have bees in my backyard in Teaneck. I have depends on the time of year, between 4 and 6 hives in my backyard. I have a number of other properties where I keep bees. The main property that I keep bees is I have a summer home in Woodridge, New York. That's where my garden is. Huh? That's where my big apiary is. When I started, I was a little bit reluctant to keep bees in a backyard, which really isn't a problem. But it's sort of – Teaneck is urban, so I was nervous. I've got neighbors and whatnot. So when I first started beekeeping bees, I kept them – in Woodridge, which is much more rural. So I figured that would be a good place to start. So I have a lot of bees in Woodridge. I've got about 10 hives there. And I also keep bees in Eldred, New York. I keep bees in Manhattan, right, looking over the Central Park. I keep bees on a rooftop in Teaneck also. It's grown to the point where I've got bees in a number of different locations. But my primary two locations are Teaneck, New Jersey, my home in Teaneck, New Jersey, and my home in Woodridge, New York.
Now, how far apart are those, like 15
miles? So I travel back and forth because I work in Teaneck. It takes me about an hour and 20 minutes. It's about 80 miles apart.
Okay.
And my bees make the trip. They don't make the trip outside the hive. They're limited to a 3-mile vicinity from the hive. But I often move hives from one location to the other. It's better to start bees in Teaneck. We have an earlier spring. But the nectar flow dies down. We have a summer dearth in New Jersey. And there's still a whole bunch of flora in upstate. So I transition bees. Early spring, I am heavier in Teaneck. And later summer into fall, I move a lot of my hives upstate because they're still productive.
Oh, my goodness. That just sounds – and you just take the hives, like, what, in the at night?
Oh, well, you know what, Jackie, you're absolutely right. We wait till evening. When I first started moving hives, I actually would seal them up. I was worried about losing a bee or two. Today, what I actually do is I position the entrance of the hive so the wind won't blow in it. I reduce the entrance so it's a very small entrance. I don't want to lock the entrance because I don't want to have to worry about temperature. And I move under the cover of darkness, so I don't have to really worry about the bees taking flight. And the interesting thing is, once the truck starts moving, the bees just make their way. Sometimes they'll hang out on the front porch on the van, but as soon as you start moving, or the pickup, they go inside the hive, and we move them with the hive open. We get to Woodridge, we put them, place them in a new place, and as long as they're 3 miles away, they're not going to return to the original location.
Oh, how interesting. And then, so then do they stay in Woodridge through the winter and you're moving back to Teaneck?
The problem with Teaneck is we always try to stay. A responsible beekeeper will respect what's either bee law. In New Jersey, they don't have bee law, but they have recommended bee practices. So I try to always stay within those recommended practices. And you're not really supposed to have on a property of my size. In Teaneck, I'm only on a 200 by 200 property. So I want to stay within the number of about 6 or 7 hives. So I never try to grow beyond that. So I can't move more than that back. So the remains, so I always make sure that I'm at that number because bees will overwinter a little bit better in Teaneck.
Oh, okay.
But the remainder of my bees, I set them up very well. I make sure for bees to survive in my area, for them to survive winter, they need 80 pounds of honey. So I make sure that my bees are chock full of honey going into winter. I feed them fondant as well. The upstate hives I insulate to give them a little bit of help with the weather. I make sure they've got a really good windbreak so the wind isn't too challenging for them. And I hope for the best. I'm running way above the national average. The national average is a survival rate of about 50 to 60%. I run 80 to 90. So I am, if I enter winter with 10 hives, I've been exiting winter with at least 8. So that's a great percentage.
Oh, that's interesting. I have so many questions already, but so 80 pounds of honey, not per hive, right?
Per hive. What happens is like this. The bees right now are sort of at their highest numbers and just starting. The queen is starting to slow down. So my hives have somewhere around 60 to 80,000 bees per hive. That number will drop. And depending on the species, most of my bees are feral bees. That means they were taken from the wild. I rescued the queens from the wild, or they're children of queens that I rescued from the wild. But those bees are descendants of Italian bees. And Italian bees go through their winter clusters a little larger than some other varieties of honeybees. But the numbers will drop to around 20,000. Now, they need those 20,000 bees to care for, insulate and warm the queen so she survives, because the queen survives in the hive over winter. Those 20,000 bees will need and food, and their food source is the honey that they collect, and they collect and store honey. So the average 20,000 bees in my area with the length of my winter will need approximately 80 pounds of honey. So we don't sit there. I don't sit there with a scale and measure, but I sort of know there's my hives are what's called Langstrom hives. Those are the boxes that you see that are filled with frames. And the average Langstrom hive, two deeps, if they're heavy, two boxes, one piled on top of each other, if they're really filled with honey, if your bees fill it up with honey and collect enough honey, will be about 80 pounds. So if they build a third box or a fourth box or a fifth box, we can harvest those. We'll always leave those first two boxes for them to fill up with honey so they can get through the winter with those 80 pounds.
Okay. So we're so new to bees. We just got our first hives really. We got a couple of hives a couple of years ago, but we got them like the end of August and they didn't make it to November, I don't think. So then we got new ones this spring. So it's very new to me. And like I said, my husband does most of it. But how do you know when the hive is full of honey? Like,
so like I was saying, when you start, when you generally, the way people start, assuming that you're using I would say 90% of the people out there are using Langstrom hives. Langstrom was a beekeeper in the, don't quote me on the time, but somewhere in the early 1800s, mid 1800s, who invented a hive that he was the one who discovered bee space, which is it's an eighth of an inch, that separation, the bees will not build burr comb. And he said by building a modular hive, you can encourage the bees to build in a way that you can manipulate the frames. So you start with one box and 8 or 10 frames, depending on the style of box that you get. Once the bees fill up that box with their honey, their nectar they're turning into honey, their brood, they're developing babies, and pollen, you add a second box. They'll fill that second box. Once that second box is full, you can then start adding your honey supers, because those two boxes are what they'll need to get through the winter. The honey supers is what you can harvest. So it's very easy for me to figure out, can I harvest honey from a hive? I go pop open the hive. If they've only got two boxes, there's nothing for me to harvest. If they got three boxes, I then just check the condition of box one and two. If it looks good, I can take box number three. If it doesn't look good, what I'll do is I've got a way of encouraging the bees to move the honey. I put basically a separation board in between box number three and box number one and two, and the bees will draw the honey from the top and bring it down and store it in their lower frames.
Okay. How often do you check the hive? Like, do you look in there?
So here's the funny thing about beekeeping. Beekeeping, most people who are beekeepers are very passionate about the way they do beekeeping. And if you ask a beekeeper, he will tell you this is the only way you could ever possibly do it. They're very insistent that this is the only and the right way, and it's got to be that way. And the beekeeper will tell you, I know definitively exactly how to make sure. And I already forgot the question that you had asked me.
How often do you check the hive?
Right.
How do
okay.
you know how?
So
when,
or, one of the major different approaches is whether you want a very hands-on approach or a very hands-off approach. And some of those beekeepers would say, you know what, the only way to do this is by checking the bees once a week. There are other beekeepers who will tell you the only way to do it is hands-off. You should borrow the bees, leave them as they are, don't bother them, and each sort of school of thought will tell you they're right and the other one is absolutely wrong. There's a book called At the Hive Entrance, which is all about beekeeping without disturbing your bees. On the other hand, there are beekeepers who tell you if you're not constantly monitoring and checking the condition of your bees, you have a very good chance of encouraging disease and also having failing queens, and a queen that's failing you'll end up losing the whole hive. So I take an approach, sort of a balance between the two. I think you have to figure like this. When you first set up your hives, if the average person starts, I recommend starting with two hives. If you start with two hives, you've got to figure spring into summer, an hour a week.
Okay.
That's maybe even a little bit more when you first set up. But once you get set up, about an hour a week. Once summer gets going, you could cut that to an hour every 2 weeks.
Okay.
At a minimum. Now, generally, I also tell people, beekeeping is the type of thing, if you take to it, it becomes an absolute passion. You're going to visit your bees more often than you have to, which is generally fine, as long as you're not going in there every day. But you'll probably visit the bees more than you have to. But it's the type of thing I generally try to get to my bees that I'm at least cracking open the covers and getting a quick look once a week.
Now, what are you looking for when you go in there?
Well, there are a couple of things that you're looking for. You're number one looking for the presence of any type of pests. There are a couple of pests that affect our hives. One of them is a small hive beetle. The other one is a wax moth. Varroa mites are present as well. Varroa mites are a huge problem and probably significantly contributing to colony collapse disorder.
Okay.
So you're checking for those pests. You're also checking to see that your queen is laying. Now, you don't even have to see her, but you got to see a good pattern of brood. Those are the developing babies. And you want to see that she's laying well. There's enough brood there. You also want to check and make sure that your bees have enough room, because if they run out of room, they're going to swarm. If they need more space, you got to add space. And if you wait too long, once they get that instinct to swarm, you're going to lose half your bees and your original queen.
Okay. Cool. All right. I have learned so much already. I wish I knew. I got to say, I have no idea how often Mike checks them, because I think he usually goes kind of towards dark. Is that when you're supposed to go?
Well, that's, again, that's also subject to debate. Your bees are returning when it gets towards dark. You don't want to wait till it's really dark. You don't want to disturb the bees at night, because they get frazzled. They don't generally fly at night, so they sort of get frazzled if you bother them once it's dark. I don't like to check midday. There's a little bit too much sun. I like to check somewhere early afternoon, because I avoid all the foraging bees. Most of the bees are out foraging, so your population is lower, so you're disturbing fewer bees. So I try to get there afternoon, but there are times, you know, life gets in the way, and sometimes I'm going early morning. Today I had somebody who wanted to visit my hives. 9 o'clock in the morning, we were cracking open the hives and manipulating some frames. So a lot just depends on convenience. As long as it's light out, there's really no terrible time to go in.
Okay. Let's see. Well, what else, I guess, should we know?
Well, let's talk a little bit about colony collapse disorder, or just the disappearance of honeybees. So there's been, in recent years, there's been an alarming rate of loss of feral, both feral and managed hives. Again, feral hives are hives that escaped from, because there are no honeybees that are indigenous to the United States. They were brought here to use for either pollinating crops or raising or collecting honey. But they, many of them escaped into the wild and established themselves, and that's called a feral colony. And feral colonies are very, very important, especially when there aren't any local beekeepers, because they do an excellent job at pollinating. And we'll take a quick break from this, and I'll tell you about pollination. Why are bees so important to pollination, and specifically honeybees? It's a numbers game. There are other flying insects that pollinate, and there are other bees that pollinate. But honeybees, their sheer numbers make them excellent pollinators. The fact that we've got 50,000 bees in a hive, of those 50,000, many thousands of bees, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 bees, are out there pollinating. So their numbers just make them super, super pollinators. But these pollinators have been disappearing, and it's both made managed hives very difficult, because if you're constantly replacing hives, and there have been, I've heard sad stories where people went into winter with 20 or 30 hives, and after winter they were left with only 5 or 6. And that's devastating, and it means a very big investment by the beekeeper, and you're set back all that time and all that work that you put into getting your bees ready. Most bees don't produce any honey for you year one in my area. Some areas they do, but in my area, they're spending that first year making those 80 pounds and drawing out all the comb and everything else. So the colony collapse disorder and just general loss of bees is a huge, huge concern. And again, why does it affect somebody? Let's say I said, you know what, I don't really particularly care for honey. Well, it's far greater than honey, because a lot of our crops, almonds, peaches, apples, pears, and many, many other crops are dependent on bees for pollination. Some crops like almonds are 100% dependent on bees for pollination. And other crops, we'd have far less fruits and vegetables had we not had our pollinators. And again, they're disappearing in alarming numbers. And the big question is why. And some of the mistakes a lot of people have made is they've hyper-focused on one thing. As an example, there's an insecticide called a neonicotoid. And a neonicotoid is an insecticide that's sprayed onto plants, generally plants that bees don't pollinate. I think it's very often used on corn and whatnot, but it's sprayed on as a powder. And that powder, the bees pick up thinking that it's pollen and return that to the hive. And obviously, if they're going to feed insecticides to their developing babies, the end result can be catastrophic. So there's been a whole bunch of focus on neonicotoids, but neonicotoids are only one of the problems, or for that matter, pesticides are only one of the problems. Another problem is loss of habitat. we have bees that used to have all this wonderful forage that we've plowed and paved, and even parks. Today, parks, half of our parks are astroturf, where they used to be open field with clover and other flowers. We've sterilized our landscape. The other thing we've done is we've gone to farming on such a large scale, whereby, as I gave you the example, the almond crops, they import tens of thousands of beehives, are transported by the migratory beekeepers over to California in early spring to pollinate our almonds. Now, that creates a number of problems. Movement of our bees also means movement of pests. And we have a proliferation of bee pests that have been moved by migratory beekeepers from one part of the United States to the other. The other problem is when you put bees in an environment where there's a single flora source, well, what happens after the bloom? You basically have a desert. And now I've got bees, and if they're not moved quickly enough, they've got no nourishment. They've got nowhere to collect pollen. They've got nowhere to collect nectar. And it's basically like starving them. And monocultures very often encourage that type. It's feast or famine. And certain crops, although they're important pollination-wise, they're not necessarily a great source of nutrition for our bees. So all of these things together, it's not a single thing. It's a combination of things that have affected our bees, and our bees are in real trouble. And we have to really look very aggressively at what are we going to do to stem the tide. And one of those things we've got to do is we've got to make sure we're planting things that are bee-friendly, flora that's going to be bee-friendly. We've got to have multiple flora. We've got to look at pesticides, use of pesticides, alternative use of pesticides, notification, just as a simple thing. If a beekeeper could be notified, well, they're going to be spraying, I can lock down my bees. I basically can blanket my beehives so that the bees won't fly. Just that, I'll give them 24 hours where they're not going to be leaving the hive and returning to the hive with poison. You know, these type of things, a lot of stuff we have to do. Fortunately, many states, New Jersey just passed a bunch of laws. Many states are drafting and looking at laws that'll help protect our bees, but certainly private individuals have to do their part.
Oh my goodness, so much stuff there. So now, all right, what was my big question that I was going to ask you was about, okay, I'll think of it in a second. But so my husband wants me to send a flyer around to our neighbors and ask them when you're going to spray, because he knows there's nothing he's going to do to convince some of these old timers not to spray, to tell him. And then he thought somehow he could keep his bees home on those days. And so putting a blanket over if you know your neighbors are going to spray is a good idea then.
Right. You have two options. You can put a wet blanket over your hive and keep it moist. And the bees, you will get some bees that'll escape, but the majority of them will not. The other thing is you can actually close your entrances. You can close your entrances. The only problem with closing your entrances, people have a hard time finding their way back. The bees that are locked out could get very aggravated. Mm-hmm. If you blanket your bees, the bees will fly back and land on your blanket, and they're not going to leave. Generally, they'll just hang out there because they can still scent the pheromone from the queen. And even if sometimes they'll make their way down to the bottom and sort of find their way in. But even if they don't, they'll hang out on that blanket until you remove it.
So do you want a blanket that goes all the way to the ground, like
all the way to the
blanket?
Floor, all the way, okay. All the way to the floor.
Would a sheet work?
It could be a sheet. Absolutely. Just keep it wet. Keep it wet.
Oh, okay. And I know what I was gonna, when you say flora, multiple flora, do you mean just flowers or like even vegetables that have blooms, just anything that they're going to eat?
Vegetables,
apple trees, you mean anything, right?
Some vegetables are fantastic. Now, certain vegetables are specific to particular, like I'll give you an example. Tomatoes are not particularly good for honeybees. They're great for bumblebees, but honeybees don't really benefit from that. My garden's got loads of bees visiting. I have a whole section for bee forage that I plant. But separate from that, I have bees visiting my bean plants regularly. My mint is regularly visited. Squash is visited more by bumblebees. I get some honeybees there, but I get a lot of bumblebees visiting my squash.
I was just asking my husband that because we were out. My goal this year was to plant an amazing amount of sunflowers. And there's, it just seems like there's more bumblebees, even though we have these hives of honeybees. And I was just curious, I asked him, like, why does it seem like the bumblebees are more, you know, there's more of those, which I don't right. know where so, they're so coming from. And
well, bumblebees are basically, although there are, you can buy bumblebee hives. Mm-hmm. They're generally used. Bumblebees their numbers are not conducive. They do make honey, but their numbers are not conducive for harvesting honey. And bumblebees are indigenous to the United States. But you can buy a small bumblebee hive, and they're generally used by like tomato gardeners and the like who need specifically bumblebees. Here's something really cool about bumblebees, and I'm certainly by far no expert on bumblebees, but bumblebees vibrate at the perfect tone to release the pollen inside the tomato plant. So the bumblebee approaches the tomato blossom, vibrates at just the right frequency, the pollen jumps off of the tomato plant and lands on top of the bumblebee. And when that bumblebee, when she flies over to her next flower, she will pollinate one tomato plant to the other. So there are just certain plants based on the design of the flower that are more conducive to certain bees rather than others. I'm not really familiar with sunflower. I've never planted it, but it sounds to me like sunflower might be one of those plants. Mm-hmm. Oh, but there are many, a lot of honeybees love herbs. Sage is a great herb for them. Mint, which most people consider a weed, but mint is a fantastic source for them. A lot of what we consider weed is also great. I've got right now goldenrod is in bloom. And by me in Woodridge, there's a whole bunch of fields which are currently not being used that are loaded with goldenrod. And I get a super goldenrod flow. Blueberries is a great crop. I get a whole bunch of blueberry honey. So again, some trees, some vegetables. And most of the honey that I collect, we call wildflower honey because I'm not specific. I'm not careful when I put and take off my boxes, but I get a nice mixture of both vegetable blossom as well as tree blossom.
Okay. So when we tried to get some beehives many years ago, like 10 years ago or something, I found this beekeeper locally and he wouldn't give us bees because he said we weren't close enough to water. And at the time, we didn't have a well. We just had a shallow well on our property. We might not even. We were here for 6 years without running water at all. So it could have even been that long ago. But, do you want to talk about the importance of water sources?
Water is very important. And if you're in a desert, you certainly would want to consider providing water close for your bees. The most important reason to provide water close for your bees are bees are going to be opportunists when it comes to water. They're going to look for the closest water source. So it doesn't have to be right near the hive, but the problem is it's not right near your hive, and the closest water source is your neighbor's pool. You're not going to make a very good neighbor. So like I had mentioned to you about good beekeeping practices of New Jersey, one of their recommendations is that you provide a source of clean running. Right. Okay. So New Jersey has their good beekeeping practices. And one of the things that they require is that you keep a close water source. And the reason is you don't want your bees foraging at a water source that's going to be on your neighbor's property. You want to sort of keep them close by. And again, they're opportunists, which means they're going to look for the closest source of water. Not so with flora, because what they do is they orient themselves above the tree line and they spread out in a 3-mile radius. So you really don't have to worry that your neighbor's flowers are going to be visited any more than anybody else's. But that's not so with water. So you want to provide a clean, close source of water. If you're in an area where you don't have a lot of neighbors, like upstate New York, I've got a lake near my property. I just let my bees go there by themselves. I don't provide them with any water. But the lake is closer than any of my neighbors, so I really don't have to worry about them wandering in the wrong place. So the answer is you sort of need a local water source, because if not, they're going to find one on your neighbor's property, which could present the problem. And if you're in a desert, your bees are going to need water, and you better provide it for them. But as long as there's in the area within a short flight from the hive, the bees will be fine.
And what's a short flight? like 100 yards, 20 yards, 1,000 yards?
I would say 1,000 yards is probably how far. 1,000 yards is probably, I'd say, let's say, certainly the closer the better, but if it's within an eighth of a mile, I'm sure it's fine.
Okay. I'm just trying, like, our neighbors had a creek, and that's where we were thinking they would go.
So that's fine. If your neighbors had a creek, they would be fine there. I have a friend who keeps bees, and he has in the behind his property, there's a creek that's sort of along the side of the road, and that's where the bees pick it up. The one thing you got to worry about a water source is you don't want a water source where they're going to drown. So if they're getting to if you put out a big bucket of water, the bees are going to land on the water and then quickly drown unless it's filled with rocks. A pond or a creek, they'll sort of just go right by the shoreline, drink there, and then fly, and they'll be fine, as long as they have a way of getting in and out. Mm-hmm. Bird feeders are often very good. Bird feeders with rocks are also a very good source.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we do all those things. Mike kind of built this little, like, creek thing bed, and we put, like, just turn the water on really low, and they love it there, and there's, like, moss growing on the rocks, and that's where they seem to go. Cool. And that's just right in our
if game. if you're really stuck, what you can do is you can make you can use one of a regular feeder and use it just as a water feeder, and leave it. You can even leave it in a hive. You can use a frame feeder and put it in the hive and just fill it every, you know, once a week.
Okay. Okay. Were you going to go back to, did we start talking about one thing and you were going to go back to it and we went to another, or no?
It could be, but I'm lost.
Okay. All right. So anything else we need to know? Sure learned a lot.
Anything else we need to know? You know what? Go off the air a second. I will look at my B slide. I give a presentation. Let's see. Swarming, we should probably talk about. That's cool.
Okay.
Let me grab. It'll take a second. I'll tell you what I discuss. I discuss the different types of bees, the queen, the worker, the drone, if you have any questions about that. The life cycle of the bees, how long bees live. The queen, we talk
about. How long do bees live?
Worker bees live 6 weeks. Queen bee can live up to 6 years, although rarely she does. Drones live also around 6 weeks. They could live a little longer. The interesting thing about bees, winter bees live considerably longer. They live 6 months. And they're basically identical genetically and just about in every way. They have a little bit of a higher fat content. But the bees born now will live 6 months. Bees born in the summer will live 6 weeks.
Weird. Okay.
The other thing that I talk about is regulation of temperature in the hive, which I basically goes through the way the bees regulate the temperature. They keep the temperature at 90 degrees winter or summer. We can talk about that if you'd like. Bee communication is very interesting. We talk about the waggle dance and the way bees communicate.
Oh, cool.
Pollen analogies. I talk about that a little bit sometimes. And then bee swarms and, you know, bees, the way the mega organism reproduces and the bees leave as a unit with the old queen and a whole bunch of bees. And then I talk about rescue, how bees end up in people's homes, and they often call me to pull bees out. So any of those things we can talk about if you'd like.
Okay. I'm not really even sure where to begin. Did you want to start with swarming, or is that at the end?
But you know what? It doesn't matter. Why don't you make a list, and then you just ask me. We'll go through, and we can do. Okay, so let's go through it again. I'll go through it again. You tell me, and I could even write myself a note. So the cast of bees you want to cover about the drones and that the men don't sting. That's that people sort of get a kick out of that the everybody in the hive are really females and the men do no work. People sort of get a kick out of that. You can mention that if you'd like. That's casts of bees. The life cycle would be. The waggle dance is very interesting.
Tell me about the waggle dance. What's the waggle dance?
Well, the waggle dance is one of the ways bees communicate. A big majority of the way our bees communicate is through pheromones. And bees have many, many different jobs in the hive. And they'll have a unique smell based on the job that they release, called a pheromone, based on the job they do. So a queen will have her pheromone. And as long as her pheromone is present at the right ratios in the hive, all is well. Guard bees have their own pheromone, and foraging bees, which are the older bees, as bees age, their job will change. And our foraging bees are generally older bees. They started life working inside the hive. Now they're going out and collecting pollen or nectar. So let's say one of those foraging bees returns from her trip. She just traveled to a patch and found a whole bunch of wonderful clover nectar. And she wants to now communicate to all of her sisters, that, or at least half-sisters, that she's got a great source of pollen or nectar. So she'll fly back into the hive and she'll release that pheromone, basically telling the other foraging bees in the hive, I've got a message for you. And they'll collect around her. And
no
then
way.
she will position herself based on the position of the sun inside the hive on one of the frames and do a dance in figure eights referred to as the waggle dance. And it's referred to the waggle dance because she sort of waggles as she moves. And based on her movement, just her movement, they are able to figure out exactly where to return to. She doesn't have to go back and lead them. The other bees, just based on her communication, will leave the hive and can fly back and find exactly that source of nectar or pollen for that matter. Amazing. Bee communication is really unbelievable.
That's crazy. How do they I just can't even imagine, but I guess they do it.
It's all positioning.
It's like
right?
They're talking.
Right. When
she's
I
saying,
lecture
follow
to kids,
this thing and follow, right. You know, go to this branch and follow that tree and go right. Around the creek. And
right. It's unbelievable. I tell people, can you imagine? I want you. I have one of the kids. I said, okay, stand up here without talking, just mime. And you can use all types of signals. Tell us how do you get to your house. And I want to see that anybody can figure it out. So it's sort of the same thing. It's amazing. Without speaking, they're able to communicate one to the other, and it's the greatest navigation system out there.
That is a great visual to understand what you're talking about. That really explained that to me. Oh, my goodness. That's so fun. Okay. And how amazing that they can do that. Do other insects, do you know, do like ants do things like that? And other?
Oh, ants definitely communicate. I don't know that they do a waggle dance, but they're – I think many of the communal insects, and you picked ants. Ants is another good example of that they live in a community, what they refer to as a mega organism. So ants also definitely have pheromones. They definitely communicate with pheromones. And I'm sure they have a movement communication also, because ants have to do the same thing. They've got to communicate a food source. So I would be surprised if it's exactly the same method, but I'm sure it's somewhat similar.
How interesting. Like in moths and butterflies, like I'm so curious now to know.
Well,
that how they
moths
all
and butterflies,
do,
I think you're looking specifically for communal insects. And not all bees are communal. There are solitary bees. But bees that are communal means they live together as a community, not just mother with a couple of children. But bees that, and even that you don't really have with bees, because bees are just, she'll lay her eggs, she'll die. The next season, a whole bunch of new bees will emerge, and then it's just male and female relationship. But communal bees, there's one queen. She does all the egg laying. All of the other bees inside the hive basically serve the mega organism. They're not serving her. They serve the mega organism. She's the only one that lays eggs. Everybody else sort of just works together, and a part of that is certainly communication.
Cool. Wow, that is so neat. Okay, how about, where'd my list go? How about the worker bees?
So worker bees are actually, there are three, this what's called the castes of bees. There are three different castes of bees. There are the queen, everybody knows the queen. There's generally, and I say generally because there are rare occasions when there is a second queen, but generally there's one queen in a hive. Other than swarming or supersedure, swarming is when the bees are splitting and creating a second hive. Supersedure is when the queen's not performing the way she should be and they're going to replace her. But other than those two conditions, there are generally only one queen per hive. Then there's the worker bees. There are tens of thousands of worker bees inside the hive, and they are all her children, unless she was replaced. But if she wasn't replaced, and even if she was replaced, within 6 weeks, they're going to all be her offspring. The queen will lay up to 1,000 or above 1,000 eggs a day. So she's busy laying eggs Right. From morning to night, that's all she does is she lays and lays and lays. And she does that from early spring or late winter all the way into late fall. She lays eggs from drones that she's mated with during her mating flight, which happened at the beginning of her life. She was a virgin queen, left the hive. If this happened in nature, sometimes people buy a fertile queen, but if it happened in nature, she left the hive as a virgin, flew above the tree line, mated with a whole bunch of drones. And that actually serves a very good purpose, because when she comes back, some of those drones will be better in certain, some of her offspring will carry the genetics of bees that are better foragers. Other ones will be better at housekeeping or just guarding or whatever. And they found that by having multiple genetics inside the hive, it actually helps for the greater health of the hive. And our last category are the drones. The drones are the males. And the males, other than on the rare occasion when a drone impregnates a queen and he does that outside the hive, not inside the hive, they really serve no purpose. And a lot of people, when I give the, when I speak, they giggle and laugh and say, oh, that's typical. The men do no work. But it's not great to be a drone either, because once the weather gets a little colder and there's really no more purpose to mating a queen, the drones serve zero purpose. And life inside the hive, although fascinating and wonderful, can also be somewhat harsh. And as soon as they serve no purpose, they're actually expelled from the hive. So this time of year, you'll all of a sudden see a big drop in drone population. And sometimes when you're standing outside the hive, you'll see worker bees actually preventing drones from entering their hive, because they consume honey, they're not contributing, and it's a tough world out there, certainly for the honeybee. So those are our three different castes of bees. Now the worker bees,
so then do they go look for somewhere else to live?
No, drones actually die during the winter. They really don't serve any purpose. It wouldn't serve any purpose. There's no more mating to be done. And what's interesting is, how does the queen decide whether to lay a drone? Or the queen actually decides. She'll pop her head into the cell. She'll then decide if the cell is formed perfectly and just the right size, she'll lay a fertile egg, an egg that's been fertilized with one of the sperm from that she stores, one of the sperm that from the drones that she had mated with at the beginning of her life.
Crazy.
But when it's a drone, it's actually a sterile egg. So the drones have half the chromosomes of their sisters, and they are genetically a duplication of their mother, because they have only her genetics, none of their father's, because there is no father. They actually have no father. It's sort of a unique, again, I don't think it's unique to them, but it's, I think, unique to the insect world, where you'll have something which has only a father, no mother, and their sisters are actually produced as through regular mating of male and female. It's a fascinating process.
I'll say that's just insane. She just decides what she's going to lay.
She decides. She'll decide
where the sperm comes from.
The sperm is stored inside. The sperm is stored inside her, and she'll decide whether to lay a.
I lost you again. Okay, where were we? She was deciding.
Right. So basically, she'll put her. She'll stick her. First thing she does is she lays an egg from the bottom of her abdomen. So the first thing she'll do is she'll stick her head inside the cell. She'll check out what the cell looks like based on how it looks and its position. She'll lay a single egg, and it'll either be a sterile egg, and that will develop into a drone, or more likely a fertile egg, which will develop into a queen, into a worker. Now, workers, all in the presence of the queen, the queen's pheromone prevents their ovaries from developing. Even if they develop, they will never be able to function as a queen. They could become an egg-laying worker, which is only happens when a hive is really failing. Egg-laying workers will produce only drones. It's sort of like a gun firing blanks. But sometimes the bees will decide it's time to make a new queen. And what they'll do is they'll find numerous eggs that were just recently laid. They'll feed them extra royal jelly, and they'll build their cell out bigger, and that egg will develop into a queen. So it's actually the community that chooses the queen, not the queen. The queen does not choose her replacement. It's actually the community that decides, okay, it's time to make another queen, or for either swarming to leave as a group, and half the bee population will leave with the old queen, and a new queen will emerge and take over as the queen in that hive. Or if the queen's failing, she's not laying enough. So that would happen. If she's not laying enough, the pheromone from the developing brood will drop in the hive, and that will alert the bees to the fact we've got to make a new queen, and they'll make what's called the supersedure queen cell. And the way you can tell, based on the position, where they make it in the hive, if they make it all the way in the bottom of the frame, that's a swarm cell, which means your bees want to swarm. They want to leave the hive because there's probably not enough room in your hive. And once they get that desire, there's no real way of stopping them without, other than breaking the hive in half. But if it's in the middle of the frame, that's a supersedure cell, which means your bees don't feel your queen is performing up to task, and they're getting ready to replace her.
Now, why would a queen be performing or not performing? Is there something happening to her? Is she sick?
Age,
is she getting old?
It could be age. Sometimes it's like anything else. Her genetics are just not up to what they should be. But sometimes it could be age. It could be poor health, poor nutrition. But very often it could just be an age thing, or it just could be her genetics. And it's a little bit of a microcosm of survival of the fittest. If she's not doing the job that they feel she should be, they're going to replace her.
But like, so then would she be like a new, like a young, like they, like a queen wouldn't be there for like 5 years and all of a sudden they decide she's gone, or 2 years, like is
sure,
it like
sure,
either right away
a,
or
no. So by the way, sometimes it could happen right away, but sometimes it could be that she's failing. After very often beekeepers will replace a queen even if everything looks good after a year or two. If I see a really good laying pattern, I'll give that queen time. As long as she's doing a good job and I can see she's laying enough eggs, things look okay. But if she starts, could be a year or two, she's producing really well for a year or two, then she starts lagging, and all of a sudden she's not laying as well as she was, the bees will replace her.
Interesting. Okay. Were we going to talk about the life cycle?
Okay, so honeybees generally live 6 weeks, and that's during the summer season. Drones can live a little bit longer. Queens can live far beyond that. Queens can live for a number of years. There have been queen bees recorded living as long as 6 years. That's unusual, but they will live. They could easily live a couple of years. And the problem is, if bees only live 6 weeks, the queen stops laying in early fall or mid-fall for sure, and she doesn't start laying again until early spring, which is way beyond 6 weeks. And the amazing thing is, winter bees, the bees that she's going to start laying soon, going into getting preparing for winter, live 6 months as opposed to 6 weeks. And it's, cool. The scientists don't exactly understand why. One of the theories were that they worked themselves to death, but they actually were able to prove that that's not the case. They isolated bees and just fed them, and they didn't have the opportunity of working themselves to death, and they also didn't live that 6 months. And basically, it's just built into the design of the bee that the winter bees, even though genetically they're identical to the summer bees, winter bees live 6 months, summer bees only live 6 weeks. The other amazing thing is that in a bee's lifetime, with all of her back and forth, she will visit millions of flowers and will only produce less than a tablespoon of honey in her whole life.
Really?
Yeah. And she works 23 out of 24 hours a day. So the expression busy as a bee is very well deserved.
Wow. What about collecting the honey?
So depending on, different beekeepers have different ways and different times of year when they collect honey. I do a big part of my harvest right now. I'm actually a little late. I should have harvested a little bit earlier, but life got in the way. But basically what we do is we go over to the hive, we remove all of those supers, all the extra, everything beyond 80 pounds. We take that into our honey house, which is basically just a clean room that's got a honey spinner in it. And we remove the capping. There's like a wax capping that goes on top of the frames. We remove that wax capping, put it into our honey spinner, and out comes beautiful honey, which is just filtered. My honey is basically just filtered and sold. I don't do any processing. It's raw honey, which raw honey's got a lot of benefits. There's some wonderful enzymes and good microbes that are in there that are very helpful and nutritious, which you're not going to get from store-bought honey, which has been micro-filtered as well as pasteurized generally. The other thing that you're getting is the presence of pollen. And people have found that by consuming local honey, it actually helps you build up a resistance. Your body builds up a natural resistance to local pollen, and thereby helping you with allergies.
Ooh, that's a good thing for people to know, because there's so many allergies anymore.
Right. The important thing to know is if you're going to use it, and I'm approached a lot by people, even though people will say that they get some benefit right away, logically it would take a couple of months. You've got to consume a teaspoon, or better yet, even a tablespoon of honey for a couple of months to get your butt. You basically, the way it works, it's exposure to the allergen. So by consuming a small amount of pollen every day inside that honey, your body is going to build up not a resistance, but a familiarity that's going to prevent you from overreacting. Because people who have allergies, it's a hyperreaction. You're viewing it as a irritant when it really shouldn't be. And by exposing your body to it over time, you'll develop a resistance or a tolerance for the pollen.
Okay, cool. And that makes a lot of sense. Like, I've learned that spider bites, like, because my husband swells up from spider bites, and I never seem to get them. And I'm like, how can this be? And I found out that he's allergic to the spider venom, I think, is why it affects him so much more than me.
Right. So here's the interesting thing. Here's the interesting thing. I rarely get stung. Mm-hmm. But I do a lot of rescues, which means I'm taking bees out of their environment. I'm opening up a wall of a house and pulling the bees out of their natural comb and putting them in a box. And at times you aggravate the bees enough that you do, even with wearing a suit, you occasionally get stung. And when I got stung, my kids would refer to me as the Michelin Man. I would blow up, even though I didn't have what's called an anaphylactic reaction, which means my throat didn't close up. I would blow up. And it was not great for lecturing. If I went there and trying to convince people to keep bees, and here's this guy who's got one side of his face looks all deformed, it wasn't a great way to encourage people to pick up the craft. So I actually went and had myself tested, and to my surprise, I was allergic to bees. And the irony was, they tested me. I get a whole battery of tests for other flying insects. I'm not allergic to wasps. I'm not allergic to hornets. I'm not allergic to any of the other stinging insects. But I am highly allergic to honeybees. So I had a choice. I was at a crossroads. I either have to give up the craft, which to me really wasn't an option, or I had to start getting stung once a week. And basically stung in a doctor's office really meant just getting exposure to bee venom. And I was getting bee venom shots originally once a week. I'm now down to once a month. And basically when I get stung now, I have a reaction even less than the average person.
Oh my goodness, you are so dedicated. I don't think anybody would do that.
There are plenty of people who get allergy shots for just exposure to dust. So to me, it was, again, it wasn't even really an option. I was so in love with the craft that giving it up wasn't really an option. And in hindsight, it really wasn't that big a deal.
Awesome. Okay. Well, that's so good to know, in so many different ways that people can do that, that there's different things you can be allergic to and different, and there's solutions to it.
Right. One thing I wanted to mention, which I think is very important, especially if there's anybody listening who's going to consider taking on beekeeping. I mentioned earlier in the program that there are different attitudes and ways of looking at what one should do beekeeping-wise. There is, and again, every beekeeper will tell you they know the only and right way to do things. One thing that I'd say has been pretty much proven without any question there's a pest called the Varroa mite, which is a very, very tiny mite that attaches itself to the honeybee. And research has shown that it's called Varroa destructor. And it's rightfully earned that name because left unchecked, there's no question that it will wreak havoc on your hive. And many beekeepers are reluctant to treat at all. And there are numerous methods of treating, some of which are very safe. But if you don't treat your bees will die. So there are people who say, I don't treat my bees. I have strong bees in this. Whatever you do, if you don't treat your bees, eventually you're certainly contributing to the problem because you're encouraging the proliferation of Varroa mites. And ultimately, your hives will fail. So the one thing I would tell, and again, there are many organic treatments that you can use. There's something called Bee Calmer, which is a just basically a whole bunch of herbs. I don't really know. I don't use it, so I don't know that much about it. But there are certainly many options that one can go about with using for treatment of Varroa mites. But Varroa mites have to be treated. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a failed hive and you're contributing to a problem that is significantly impacting general bee health.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, we just got an email yesterday from the guy we got our bees from telling us to check for the mites.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's really the interesting thing is it's not that you I do what's called a alcohol roll. But you don't have to check. You have to treat. So in other words, some people say, look, I don't really feel comfortable because to check very often you have to kill a couple of bees. So I believe it's a sacrifice worth making anyway, because for the better good of the hive, that's sort of why bees sting. They give up their life for the better good of the hive. Well, for the better good of the hive, it's probably best to check. But even if you're reluctant to check or you're not so comfortable with the whole checking process just because of its difficulty, treat. It's not going to hurt because there's almost no such thing, and unfortunately, there's almost no such thing as a hive in the United States without the presence of any Varroa mite. And if you're treating, you've got a far better chance. So I would tell people, check if you can. Do a mite count regularly if you can. If you're reluctant to do it, just make sure you're doing some sort of treatment.
Do you want to tell us about the alcohol roll?
So alcohol roll is, and there are some people that do a sugar roll, a powdered sugar roll, which is not as effective. Basically, you're taking approximately 200 bees. You're putting them in a jar. You're filling that jar with alcohol, and then there's a little, and that kills the bees. So you're sacrificing those 200 bees. You then shake the jar.
Sure. What kind of alcohol? Like rubbing alcohol or vodka or
it does anything that'll kill the bees. It doesn't matter. What you're basically doing is you're killing the bees and detaching the mites. The mites are attached to the bees. They basically are bloodsuckers. They attach to the bee and they are a vector for all types of disease. But they also, what they do is the adult Varroa mite enters the cell of the developing brood before the cell is covered and capped. And once it's cut, and she hides in there. She hides underneath the pool of food. Once it's capped, now the adult bees can't protect the developing baby and can't go after that Varroa mite. The Varroa mite then will lay a whole bunch of eggs inside the cell, and they will feed off of the larva. And the problem is that developing larva will very often develop and she'll be somewhat deformed, often will not have the ability to fly. But then the adult mites attach themselves to adult bees, and they're a vector for all types of disease. So that combination just wreaks complete havoc on the hive. Okay. And they multiply at alarming rates. So even if you check and you're like just below the threshold, yeah, that's why I said you might as well treat anyway. If you don't treat within a couple of weeks, you're going to end up well above the threshold. They are basically very, very difficult. Some people try to use a powdered sugar to treat the bees where they'll just naturally groom. People try to get bees. There are certain bees, the Russian hybrid or even the Russian bee, Russian honeybee, is more resistant to our Varroa mites, but none of them are resistant enough that you don't have to treat.
I either missed something or didn't understand something. So you take these 200 bees, you put them in a jar, you put the
alcohol in. Oh, because I didn't finish. I got distracted. You didn't miss a thing. I just got distracted. So basically, right. The jar has a lid on it that has holes that are small enough that the varroa mites can get through. However, the bees can't. So you put the 200 bees inside a jar. You close the jar with this cover that's got a screen on top of it. You pour the alcohol in. That will kill all the bees. You let it sit there for a little bit. You shake it up. And what that does is it kills all the bees, but more importantly, it dislodges the varroa mites. Then you shake the alcohol and the varroa mites out of your jar by turning the jar upside down, and you shake it into a clear white bowl. And then you can count your mites, and based on the number of mites, if you have more than like 6 mites, you're way above the treatment level. Sometimes you can pour out and you'll have 30, 40 mites, and then you're like catastrophically above. So it's a good idea to check. Some people do the same exact process with powdered sugar. It is not as effective because it does not do as well. Good, it doesn't kill your bees, so that's the advantage. The disadvantage is it doesn't dislodge as many bees. So if you're reluctant to lose those 200 bees, remember your queen's laying 1,000 a day. But if you're reluctant to lose 200 bees, go ahead and do the powdered sugar roll. And just if your numbers, instead of being, if you count 4, assume you really had 6. If you count 6, you really probably had 8 or 9. Just increase your numbers because it's not as accurate.
Okay, but I still am not understanding how this is treating the hive.
That's not treating. That's checking.
Okay.
That's checking. That's not treating. You want to know how many mites I have per 200 bees. You can multiply that out and figure out how many mites you have, what type of problem you have. So the way I treat is, and I switch the type of treatment I use Mite Away Quick Strips, which is formic acid, which is naturally occurring and present in honey. So I treat with formic acid 1 year and the other. So I switch off every year because I don't want my bees to build up a resistance. And that's basically just a strip that you put into your hive, and that dissipates very quickly. It is a little bit harsh. Again, it's present inside honey, so you could even put it on with your honey supers in place. But I also like something called Apivar, which you put on when you don't have any honey for harvest. It's a contact pesticide. So it's will not travel through your entire hive, but when you put it in an area where your bees are going to walk and through contact, they will come in contact with this strip of Apivar, whereby it will, and it's doesn't harm bees, but is toxic to varroa mites. And okay. That's a much longer process. That takes about 6 weeks.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. Okay, wow, I'm glad you went through that in detail because like I said, we did just get that email yesterday saying
right.
Check your hive for mites, but it didn't have any, it just said go figure out how to do that.
Right, well, that's you can do. But again, if you're reluctant to do it, you're just starting out, I just tell beekeepers, go ahead and treat. You'll worry about next year checking, especially okay. It's late in the game. And regardless, I could almost guarantee you're going to have to treat. So you might as well just treat. The first year, I would recommend treating with Apivar. It's just okay. Very easy to use. Bee Calmer is another option. That goes on, I believe, as a paste that goes on a tray that you just slide into the bottom of the hive. And that's a organic treatment for varroa mites.
Okay.
I don't think it's quite as effective, but it's certainly better than doing nothing.
Okay. So,
by the way, the other thing to mention is what makes honey organic. And I don't claim that my bees are collecting organic honey. The problem is, remember we spoke about bees travel in a 3-mile vicinity from the hive. Unless you can determine that everyone within 3 miles of your hive does not treat their crops with any sort of insecticides and everybody within a 3-mile radius is organic or can be organic certified, you can't certify your honey as organic. So certainly my honey is 100% natural. The big, I think I mentioned this earlier, the big advantage is nectar is not a good conduit for insecticides. Insecticides is commonly found inside pollen, and I'm participating in a study in New Jersey to determine how much presence there is of insecticides in our pollen. But they've tested many, many times the honey, and the honey is just not a is not conducive to storage of insecticides. So even if some of your neighbors, which you hope there's very little of it making its way back to your hive, but even if there is a bit, it's not going to end up, it shouldn't end up in your, inside the honey.
Okay, interesting. That's good to know. So I just had two quick questions because we're over an hour. Wow. What would you tell someone who's starting out? Like if somebody doesn't have any hives or they want to get it, like what would be your advice for somebody who's brand new?
Right. So the first thing I tell you, and I get a lot of calls and I do a 101 beekeeping class once a year. I tell everybody, make sure you start by reading a good book. Now's the time to start for next year. The first thing is go out and get a really good book on basic beekeeping. Penn University has one online. You got to search for it. But if you find their one online, it's absolutely free. It's an excellent book. There are a number of other very good basic beekeeping books, but read up a lot. Join a beekeeping club. There are clubs throughout the United States. Become a member of a club, attend their meetings, and make sure you find yourself a really good mentor, someone you can call if you have questions. And lastly, the best way to start is with two hives, not one, not four. And the reason why is, one, you're not going to have a base of comparison, and you're never going to have two hives that are doing exactly the same thing. So it's good to have two hives so you can say, yeah, this hive's doing a little better. I like the way this looks in this hive. It's always good to be able to have a comparison. And starting off with two and not three, four, five, six, or seven, then you're not going to get overwhelmed and you can be able to keep the management up pretty well. That would be my recommendation. And again, I can't stress the importance of a mentor, having someone to call. I got a question. Can you come over and look? Can I come over to your hives and see what things look like there? And it's a wonderful craft. There's a lot of benefits. It's also the greatest time to sort of get away from everything. Once you put on that bee suit and you light up that smoker, the world sort of disappears. I teach at the York Prep School, so after I generally finish the class, we're taking off our bee suits, I turn to the kids and I say to them, guys, you know what time it is? And they're always shocked by the time because it's the only time these kids are away from their cell phones, they're away from their texts, they're away from all technology. It just becomes you interacting with the bees, and it's really a super release, and it's something that thank God the craft is on an upswing. There are a lot of people who are becoming backyard beekeepers, and I'd certainly encourage anyone who wants to take it up, start with your reading. And just as far as the time schedule, you got to start with your reading. You've got to order your bees early because bees, all the suppliers of bees end up running out of bees, and you can get a package of bees or you can get a nuke, which is a small hive. But you've got to get your orders in. I'd recommend by January, and right after January, start thinking of buying your woodwork, putting it together and getting ready. And you can visit me. My website is njbees.com. There should be a fair amount. It's mostly dedicated to rescue, but there's also a fair amount of information there about beekeeping.
And then did you want to say anything about what people can do to help with like the colony collapse or the supporting, you know, legislation?
Right. So
that way?
So certainly you should be speaking to all of your and any of your local politicians and stressing the importance of honeybees. We should plant even in your front yard or anywhere else. You should be planting bee friendly and you can just look them up. There's a whole list of bee friendly flora that you can plant. As an example, I mentioned to you that I have a garden. All of my walkway in the garden are all planted with clover. If I could rip up every piece of grass in my house in upstate and replace it with clover, I certainly would. That's only one example, but clover is a great pollinating crop and it's a great source of nectar for our honeybees. So, but there are many, many other examples. Just encourage people, whether it's in the pot in front of your house or it's bee forage that you plant in your backyard, or we encourage our politicians that all of our center medians on the highway should be planted with flora that would be conducive to bee forage.
That's a great idea.
There's something really cool if people would look up. If you Google online the Whole Foods and bees, Whole Foods bees or something along those lines. They have a picture of what the supermarket would look like if we didn't have bees. They have a picture of what the grocery aisle looks like, or the fruits and vegetable aisle looks like with bees, and then another picture of what it looks like with had we lose our bees and what would happen to our food source. And it's frightening. It's worth looking at and crazy frightening. And I think that's sort of a wake-up call. People are becoming aware of the importance of bees, and we all could do our part. And the other thing, which is not a bad idea, is make sure that your water sources, if you notice that there are honeybees near your water sources, make sure they got a good way of getting in and out so you're not drowning them.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I'll try to put all those links in the show notes, like the one to the Penn, what was it, the University of Pennsylvania?
I'll send that to you. I'll send that to you if you'd like.
Okay, cool. Yeah, and I'll put that in the show notes so people can just come here and your website and the Whole Foods thing. I'll try to find that.
Okay,
so Daniel, I do always like to end the show with my final question, which is, if there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or globally? And it could be, you know, colony, I mean, whatever.
Well, you know what? I certainly I have a bias and a slant towards honeybees, but I think I could sum it up with four words: clean air, clean water.
Oh, I like that.
Whatever it is that contributes to that, if you're not concerned about those, if we don't have those two things, there's no way we can live. We need clean air and clean water. Bottom line, everything else is all secondary. It's something that we should take for granted. We can't anymore. I think some people say air is free. Well, it's not so free anymore. But clean air, clean water is what we certainly need.
Thank you so much for coming on, sharing with us your wealth of knowledge. And just, I know you're going to get listeners excited, and bees are so good for the garden. I had another guest on who talked about wildflowers. She wrote a book called Taming Wildflowers up in Canada. And she talked about how, because the wildflowers were next to the vegetable gardeners, farmers who had the wildflowers even just next to their, how much the pollinators would improve their vegetable growth.
Absolutely.
And I think,
absolutely.
Know, this is a good testament to that. All right. Well, thank you so much. Have a great week.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow local.